pressure is on because this is Star Trek, and not just any Star Trek, but Star Trek. And I you know, that's the title. So
Star Trek parentheses 2009 end parentheses.
It's one of those things where I kind of wish they had called it something else, but I guess it, you know, it works because you're going back to the beginning, you're going back to what it was in the 60s, like it was just Star Trek in the 60s, you know, no additives, no xanthan gum. And so we've got, you know, that is your starting point and that's what you're circling back to, so call the movie that. But it just... It's a little confusing when you're talking about it, because then you're just saying Star Trek, and then you're saying, but in Star Trek, but in Star Trek, but in Star Trek, and then it's like, that doesn't, it's not helpful.
It's the JJ Star Trek.
Yeah, JJ Trek. And
it's hard to divorce this from him. Even though, there were a bunch of different directors for all of the other movies, this one is very specifically tied to him, probably mostly because of the controversy around it, right?
Well, I think this
controversy in giant air quotes, I should say.
Yeah, I think this is mainly tied to JJ because he has some strong opinions about how to do things that aren't necessarily the way that things have been done in the past. And I you know, that can backfire. There was a director who wanted to buck the trend of whatever Star Trek did and do his own thing, and that was Stuart Baird, who directed the Star Trek movie immediately preceding this in 2004, which was Nemesis, and that was a bad movie, and he resented the material and sort of directed it like a generic action film, and it had no fun, it had no levity or anything. JJ, while not really being a Star Trek fan, was still working with writers who were Star Trek fans and was still trying to preserve some sense of fun. Now, sometimes that comes at the expense of other things, but in general, you wind up with a movie that you can sit through and walk out and go, "Oh, that was something I saw."
What did the fun come at the expense of in this movie, in your opinion?
Well, there's some slapsticky stuff that, you know, some people might like more than others, and like, you know, there's like the you know, faking the flu, and then another shot, and then another shot, and then the whole thing with like getting in the bed and blah blah blah, blah in the bed, and then the little assistant that Scotty has, who is sort of played for like comic relief in a weird way. It's just like, okay, so there's that. It's not a big deal. Like, there are worse things in Star Trek. I'm just saying. Like, I'd rather have this than the deadly awful Star Trek Nemesis, where fun was something that should be shot on site, and not with a camera. And so this is you know, it's got some more going on.
Yeah, I agree. So, you want to briefly discuss the elephant in the room, that is the fact that a lot of hardcore Star Trek fans hated this when it came out or got really mad about it?
Well, see, I've never been able to gauge exactly how much of the fans hated it or disowned it or anything. And I don't know, even comparatively speaking, like how much of that would be like, you know, the Star Wars prequels to the Star Wars fans. Like, well, you know, it's tough to figure that out.
There's probably a difference between that comparison, because the prequels I think are universally panned, where this movie is enjoyed by a sector of people that is not necessarily the sector of people who enjoyed the originals, but people like this movie.
Yeah, but there are fans who like the originals who also like this movie, and some who also like the second film. And we'll see who likes the third one. And the this one, you know, it has some stuff where people are like, you know, it's a fun action romp, but it's not the Star Trek that, you know, I personally like, that I'm familiar with. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's bad. It's just, you know, it's what it is. It's different than the other Star Trek.
Did that make you sad that it was different?
No, I wasn't sad, but it makes it a little difficult if you want to get really picky about reconciling the two things, but it's not like the end of the world. Like, there are bigger inconsistencies in Star Trek prior to this than this film. But it's an interesting take where you get to see characters that you like sort of get a breath of fresh air for a modern audience. It's not necessarily something where you're going to be preserving everything about the original source material. And so some people find that more objectionable than others. And some people were perfectly fine compartmentalizing this into, you know, the JJ reboot. This is fun, but it's not what I'm familiar with. So, you know, there's just different ways to approach this. And I really don't think it's as universally maligned as you perhaps indicated.
No, I mean, I got to get your opinion because you're one of the old school fans. So you would be as close as I could get to somebody who would represent the people who might have a bit of issue with this movie, because I enjoy the movie. I think it is a very good movie. It's a well-made movie. I in my limited exposure to the original stuff,
when you've seen it in the machete order?
Yes, the machete order of the Star Trek films. I try and reconcile it, and, you know, I keep coming back to, like, you know, I understand where people would be a little turned off because, you know, the older Star Treks had more of that that sort of the feeling behind them that it's about this, you know, noble goal and the diplomacy and all that, you know, social stuff that it really pioneered. And this movie kind of eschews all of that and goes in the direction of kind of taking the character archetype or almost stereotype in some instances and then just like dialing them up to 12 and then throwing them into a pit of Wolverines and watching what happens, because the pace in this movie is ludicrous. There's no room for like level-headed diplomacy in this movie, really. It's just it punches you in the face for the first like hour, which is enjoyable. And, you know, I mean, use the phrase modern audience, which is kind of like a way of excusing a lot of that action stuff, but it's true. Like, I mean, this is the kind of thing that appeals to a modern audience, and it is playing with the characters and the environment and the world and, you know, a lot of that same stuff that people are familiar with, but it feels incredibly different than any of the past stuff. And I don't know if that's just the age of the past stuff or if there really was a conscious effort to step aside from some of the pacing or the tone of some of the previous stuff and really just like hit it a lot harder. But it certainly feels like that's what happened, whether they were really aiming for it or not.
Well, I think JJ was aiming for a different pace. And I don't know if it's necessarily his objections to prior films necessarily. But I think this is more what he's comfortable with. As you can see, if you watch The Force Awakens, and as we talked about then, there's sort of a ridiculous series of events that happen back to back to back to back to back as they get off the planet. They go through the battle, get up to space, can't get out, get hauled onto another ship, go through a thing with monsters going through halls, then get off the ship, go immediately over to the other place. Like there is some back to back stuff there. Like I think he just doesn't like having characters sitting around talking very much, which is probably better for most people in the audience, because that is something people frequently object to about Star Trek, is that there are a lot of people talking about philosophical ideas that are really kind of boring in a conference room setting.
Well, and I think at least in the beginning of this movie, he does a great job of sort of economizing both the action that sets up the time and place and the characters. And, you know, every one of those set pieces that is moving a million miles an hour really... it gets right to the point of what you need to know about this person. Like, you know, we establish in the very beginning, you know, where we are, what's going on, technology year, and, you know, the bad guy kind of thing. And then we in a ludicrous scene get to really understand the personality of Kirk. And then, you know, the struggle of young Spock and how he's growing up and he's very conflicted. Like, I mean, it's action-packed, but it's straight to the point, and it's very clear what we're trying, what we need to take away from each of these scenes in the beginning there before they get to the academy, and then we have a title graphic that says 3 years later, which is a bit odd, but, like, the pace is not like wasted. So it's not like mindless action. There is a very specific intent to all of the high speed action. I think it works pretty well.
Yeah, I think JJ likes playing with the animal part of your brain, the little lizard brain, if you would, to make you feel things in the theater. And sometimes when you get out, they don't always necessarily add up super well. We'll perhaps get into a couple of those things later on, but it's certainly very effective at keeping you in the moment in what's happening in the film. So it's not like he generally doesn't do things that just make you go, huh, what, why am I watching this? Like that happens elsewhere, for other filmmakers. But, this is one of the reasons why I like it. Now, let's just start with the beginning of the film, since we've basically covered that some people don't like it and some people do like it and blah. So let's talk about that. At the beginning of the film, we get the Star Wars logo. We get the Paramount Pictures logo, and the stars going, and then the music over it. And we get Spyglass Entertainment, and it's like, that's kind of weird because we don't usually see that. And then we get Bad Robot, and that's like, oh, that's really depressing that you put that on front of a, you know, major motion picture, because that is a cartoonish, juvenile logo that should not be seen by anyone. What happened to the old good old days of just doing like text of like Bad Robot in like Euro style? Like, yeah, what happened
with their ridiculous production company names? When will they learn?
I don't even care about the name. I just it's like animated Brownian motion clouds. It's like what is this? Like why are we seeing this? Like the caliber of the production of that is just awful.
That's the updated one too. It used to be all hand drawn, didn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think I think it originally started as just a sketch, and then they had one that looked like flash animation, and then this is the one where they did it in 3D, and it's just like, you guys aren't really like making it better, but whatever. Keep spending money. I just wish it wasn't at the front of the film. And it's one of those things where I'm glad it's not at the front of the Star Wars Force Awakens, because that would have been crap, if I may say so. Now we go from that to some beeping and stuff, because that's what you hear in space. And we we do an interesting camera move where we sort of like spiral around a ship, and now it's not the Enterprise, and we can tell immediately from the silhouette because it's just not designed exactly the same, but it does appear to be a Federation ship. If you are familiar with, you know, it's got some little stick things and then the big round thing, and so they're flying towards a thing, and there is lens dirt and lens flares, and every time I see it, I just look at the lens dirt and I'm just like, wow, that's something, because it's like there wasn't really like a camera crew there, but I don't want to harsh on it too much. I think it's a personal preference thing, and that I just personally don't like it. But it's definitely something that has been discussed, shall we say, on the internet, is the amount of things happening to lenses in this film.
I tend to lean a little bit towards your perspective on the lens smudges and schmutz, but I have no problem with the lens flares. Obviously, you kind of need something for the lens, the light to flare off of. But yeah, the smudges and stuff is a little overboard. But the beeping and the echoey and the quietness and the light, the way it's used in reflection of the space scenes, I actually quite enjoy, because I think it's a good separation, and I think it sort of gives a very ethereal feel to a lot of the stuff. I wish they would have been a little bit more restrained on some of the flares, like on planets, because that felt like there was intended to be sort of a delineation between, you know, the way light travels in the vacuum versus like on the planets and stuff. But like halfway through the movie, that just kind of goes out the window in favor of just sort of lens flares and cinematic look and whatever. But I mean, still, I like the look of this film. There are a lot of lens flares. I don't think it was, you know, I don't think it ruins the movie or anything.
No, I didn't say it ruins the film.
No, you didn't, but I think somebody out there was thinking it.
Yeah, well, stop thinking that. it is a personal taste thing, and I think JJ even had a comment to that effect when he went to go do the sequel to this, where he's like, yeah, we kind of maybe went a little overboard, so maybe we're going to pull it back a little bit. And then
It was his iOS 7, and then they dialed it down for iOS 8.
Yeah. And there were many jokes leading up to The Force Awakens coming out about how it was going to be, you know, just covered in lens flares because of these Star Trek films that he had done, since that is obviously what got him the job doing the Star Wars films. And it didn't turn out to be the case. There is far more restraint shown in those films than you see here. So that joke didn't really pan out when it went into production. But here it's just sort of astonishing sometimes the amount of them, and it can overwhelm what's happening in the frame. But it doesn't always. It's not that big of a deal. But I mean
it's another way to add some kinetic energy to shots of people like sitting in chairs on a spaceship. And you know, how else do you really have the what tools do you have to communicate things like speed, scale? You know. You're in space, you're on a spaceship, you have your own little gravity and world and stuff. Like, you know, you kind of need something to, aside from sound design, you need to do something to sort of make the audience feel what's going on. And it certainly does a great job of that. It might be overboard, but then again, you know, the pace of this movie, it's kind of on par with the pace and the action of the movie. So I think it fits, but it is, you know, completely unrealistic. But then again, we're talking about flying around in space and stuff.
Yeah, well, we're talking about flying around in space in Star Trek, and which is also completely unrealistic. Let's not kid ourselves. This is not our 23rd century by any stretch of the imagination. And they come across a thingy in space, and the captain is you know, all concerned about the thingies. It's no one we've ever seen before, and there are other people on the bridge, and we don't know what bridge this is, and we can't really figure out what's happening. But it all starts to gel together very quickly, that something is coming out of a rift thingy, and that, oh no, and then it fires immediately on them, because that's what you do, and then he calls, and he shouts for the date, because that's also what you do after you shoot at somebody. Because suppose he had blown them up, then he wouldn't know the date. I don't understand.
he asked the guy when he brought him over on the little spaceship. He wasn't just like, comes out of the black hole. What year is it? Like Jumanji or whatever.
Yeah, well, but like, if that was an important fact, why did you shoot at them at all? Why didn't you just show up and then ask them, like, what's happening?
Well, I mean, he may not have necessarily known that he had just traveled through time through a black hole. I mean, it seemed kind of like a new thing to them, and he was previously just engaged in battle with, sort of an attack on Spock's little tiny loopy ship.
Yeah, but then there's also, like, why invite him to slowly come over to you in a shuttle and to ask him what the date is?
he's got one move when it comes to attacking and intimidating people. You mess up their ship. You take their captain, you see what kind of information he's got for you, which I think they were just trying to feel him out. Like, what do you have special information that will help us go attack other people? And it's like, oh, this guy is entirely useless. Why is this guy so useless? Oh, it's a really long time ago.
It still strains critical thought, but he does the thing, and
we can get it out of the way up front. Yeah. Nero is kind of an aimless anarchistic bad guy who's just like, I got nothing to live for anymore, but I got a starship and I'm gonna blow some people up.
Nero is a horrible bad guy, and as we see more of him as the film progresses, it's just like, why was he written this way? Like, it feels frustrating to me.
It's mysterious.
Well, it feels frustrating to me because it's such a wasted opportunity. There is much more that could be done with somebody who is seeking vengeance, and that which is something that frequently comes up in Star Trek, because as we discussed in our episode that we did with Todd Vaziri, who incidentally worked on this, and is probably cringing at everything we're saying, we talked about Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, and That's the Goldfinger of Star Trek, basically, where that's the template that everybody keeps going back to. And so you have your bad guy who's seeking vengeance every now and then, and again. You have your convoluted plots involving super weapons, which are featured here. You've got some sort of brain parasite, which is also here, but it's slightly different. It goes in the mouth, not in the ear. And so there's those sorts of things where We see them over and over and over again, repeated throughout all the other Star Trek films that you have not seen, and sometimes in the television series, which I know that you also have not seen, except for that, what was that one that you had to watch, that Enterprise episode? Oh, so so terrible.
Oh, yeah, the one with the two races and the stuff.
Yeah, but did you catch this time when you watched it that they made a reference to Enterprise when they talked about Admiral Archer's dog?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
They said it was a prize beagle, though. Was it? It wasn't a beagle, was it?
It was a beagle.
His name was like a lab or something.
Nope. Beagle named Porthos.
I don't feel so bad now.
Yep.
I mean, I feel bad for the dog, but, you know, it's what's his name? It's Quantum Leap guy.
Yeah, Scott Bakula.
what does he know about physics and stuff?
Physics and stuff. No, so they mainly set up the scene like this so that they can get Kirk's dad in charge of the ship, played by A. Hemsworth, and they can get Kirk's mom giving birth on a shuttle with an alien lady who has giant, weird... I distort eyes, which always just bug the crap out of me.
There are a couple shots where it's like whip pan to a generic line of crew members, and there's like one random weird alien person in the back, which is a little weird. But again, this is another one of the, this is the first spot, I think, where the movie really economizes the things that you need to know. But it's one of those ones where you go like, oh, they're under attack, and Kirk just got promoted to captain, and his wife is pregnant, and she's literally about to give birth right now as they're ejecting, and he's about to die. It's like, you don't... I get that we need to set up a lot of material to get to the next thing, because this movie is still 2 hours long, but you packed a lot of stuff in the first, like, 30 seconds.
Well, I agree that the timing seems oddly coincidental, but the overall effect, though, works on you emotionally as you're watching it. And you know what? I'm not gonna lie. When I saw this at the Hollywood Bowl last weekend, in front of a crowd of thousands of people, and an orchestra playing all the music, and the being conducted by David Newman, the Galaxy Quest composer, not the composer of this film, Michael Giacchino came out and did a weird intro thing, but I'll save that for later. The thing about that was, I still teared up a little bit at the whole thing where, you know, he's got to stay on the ship because the autopilot is down, the go in a straight line is down, and you know, he's got to protect everybody from the stuff, and he sacrifices himself, and this is an important thing. It's a big deal, and you feel sad because the little baby Kirk is not going to have a father Kirk.
See, I was worried that it was just because I was completely sleep deprived that I got emotional, but it's apparently it works on robots too. Disclaimer: Joe's not a robot.
No, but
he does hate things like love and babies.
I do hate love, comma, and babies. Yes,
that's what I said.
I it kind of ran together a little bit, so I want to make sure nobody listening
on loving babies.
No, let's not do that. Okay, so moving on. the we see a nice little ship shot of the disabled vessel from the other ship running into the other ship, kaboom, and all the little shuttles getting away very, very, very slowly.
Just barely, though, because they were using their blasters to keep the torpedoes away from all of the escape ships.
Yeah, and then we start with the music, and we get the title and a lens flare, and we go to the rural area of Iowa, which features Futura, Iowa, up in the upper left corner, where they
3D
chose
Futura.
Where they chose to put the letters for the things in this, I don't understand. It's just like
they didn't want to obstruct your view of beautiful Iowa.
Yeah, I know. And so then we see someone peel out in a little old vehicle, and it turns out it's Kirk.
An old vehicle? It's a Corvette.
Yeah. And so he's driving, listening to Beastie Boys, and a lot of people object to the use of Beastie Boys. I don't care. And he's driving along, and he gets a threatening phone call.
His Nokia radio / cell phone with the old Nokia sound.
It's good to know that Nokia survives to the 23rd century somehow.
Well, the car is an antique, so maybe it's like, you know, 50 years old, but at least it still receives phone calls.
Well, except Nokia is not really like a company that makes any sort of phone call product anymore. But
oh, right. Fair enough.
Yeah. That lasted really long.
Well, in another 50 years when the Microsoft brand is fully tanked, they'll be like, why don't we just pivot to Nokia? We already own the thing.
Oh, yeah, that's right. They'll just...
Actually, no, they don't own the name. They just own the mobile product. Never mind.
Yeah, because they didn't buy the company. Well, somebody will figure it out.
Nokia will buy Microsoft back.
Mm-hmm.
So they can have their phones again.
Yes. They'll finally have their revenge. and so... anyway, the stepdad calls and he threatens the kid. So instantly dislike stepdad, check mark. And the kid drives along, passes another kid we don't know, and so goes.
This is one instance where I guess they intentionally left it out, but I missed it. You know, his mom is off planet, so he's stuck with terrible stepdad. And then later, there's just no addressing his family whatsoever. Did they all die, or do we just we don't need to know anything more about why Kirk is just wandering the land, getting in bar fights, and you know, doing whatever he feels like doing?
Yeah, well, you see, the thing is, his family was super important to him when he was very, very, very unborn, and then as time progressed from that point, family was less important, and so when we cut away after this child scene, they are no longer mentioned ever again. Except for the dad being brought up in a way that inconveniences him, but the mother and the stepdad are not mentioned, which seems odd given what he's going through. But maybe they died in the intervening years and they didn't feel like that was worthy of including, which is also strange. But whatever,
the trauma of the events surrounding his birth were so rough on literally everyone that their relationships were completely unreconcilable, even though they hadn't begun to develop their relationship yet because he was one day old.
Yes. And so he drives the car off a cliff, and there's some sort of cyborg cop, robot cop, or guy who just has a mask. It's not really super clear who has a flowing motorcycle.
Has that been on robot or not yet? Because it should be.
We should suggest that. Because it's not really made clear exactly what that is, although he's like, citizen, pull over.
He takes his glasses off so he can see better with his robot eyes. It was really weird.
I don't know what's happening with that. Here's
one other question, too, in the same scene, because I have another sort of loose end. The kid he flies past that he knows and like waves at, I was really expecting him to be a thing or a person that would come back and like mean something.
Nope. And so
I was like, in this version, is he like childhood friends with Bones and they get separated for a while and then get back together later? Is that who that kid's supposed to be? Because he's the one with the dark hair. But no, he's just Johnny or whatever they call him, and then he's gone.
Yeah.
And why is that kid hitchhiking? Where is he going?
Out of Iowa. as you can see, parental supervision isn't what it used to be in the 23rd century. We flash forward, like you said, and there's the bar and the shipyard, which is in Iowa for some reason. There's Starfleet officers there doing Iowa work, I guess.
This is the difference between this and the other movies, right? They don't build spaceships on Earth, do they?
No. The original Enterprise, NCC-1701, was supposed to be built at the San Francisco shipyards, but it was always assumed that that meant San Francisco orbital shipyards, because the ships don't really land, because they would just snap apart. Now, that doesn't really seem to be a problem for JJ. So, whatever. That's why they have dry docks on Earth for some reason.
They build our current spaceships on Earth and then fly them up.
Slightly different construction. But at least they're not building them underwater and then having them slowly rise up out of the ocean and then hover over an island. But that's, we'll save that for another day.
It rises out of a dust cloud. So in the bar scene, this is really where you get your first look at what adultish Kirk is like, and he's charismatic and kind of goofy, and he can fight, but he's likable, but while also being a bit of a putz,
and kind of like skeevy. Like there's something really sketchy about him.
I don't know. I think he's all about a good time because his life is entirely aimless, which is kind of the point of this. But I think he comes off as amusing and mostly likable in the opening scene.
Yeah,
particularly because Uhura is like, yeah, he's bothering me, but I can handle it. And she's like laughing off most of his like conversation.
Yeah, although I do hope that this did not inspire anyone to behave like this towards any women, because something tells me that they probably wouldn't get it laughed off quite as well. But the you know, he's trying to play it cool, and it's hard to watch. But he finally
he wants to buy her a drink, and he wants to know her name, and he's confused, and yeah, he's a drunk guy at a bar ordering more drinks, and he's just having a conversation, and then he gets in over his head with fighting some enlisted men or cadets or whatever.
Cupcake. And
Cupcake.
So
I like Cupcake guy.
Yeah, they duke it out. And then this brings in Captain Pike. Now in the original series, there was a Captain Pike, and he was in the first pilot of Star Trek. He was later written into, they sort of like reused clips of that first pilot in a later episode called The Menagerie, where they had a reason why he needed to get back to some alien planet that he'd come across so that he could be at peace, because he could like live inside of his mind even though his body didn't work anymore. Anyway, it's convoluted, but that's why there is a Christopher Pike. Now, Christopher Pike and Kirk didn't know each other. They were neither best buds nor enemies, so this kind of changes that relationship. Also, Pike is significantly older than Kirk here. Doesn't really matter, like I said. It was sort of based on that one thing from that one episode. So they make some jokes about that in Futurama that are more interesting than talking about this. And this is played by Bruce Greenwood, who I think does a very good job at being kind of a father figure to Kirk in many ways, in the few scenes that he is in. And he talks to him at the bar about what he could be doing with his life, about his father, about how he had written his dissertation on Kirk's father, that if Kirk was anything like his dad, he could, you know, be very useful to Starfleet. Now, I'm not sure this is how genetics works, but it seems to have inspired Bruce Greenwood as Christopher Pike to relay this to Kirk. But
yes, he is a born leader or whatever. But the whole, you know, your dad was an honorable man who did the right thing and saved a bunch of people and then died before he could instill any of those values in you. It doesn't really work out too well, but you know, you do get the emotional connection. That's like, yeah, your dad was a good guy and he did good stuff, and you probably have a little bit of talent, or you at least probably have the ego that would want to try and see if you could live up to your old man or surpass him. So let's see what you can do.
Yeah, so we'll see if we can live up to Thor.
I don't know why Thor didn't just take his hammer out and then like grab the lightning storm in space with the hammer and redirect it somewhere else.
Yeah, because it was only the bad guy from the Ten Rings organization from the first Iron Man who was the captain. So
the what?
And it was versus the Hulk, the first Hulk.
Oh, what? Yeah. That was the bad guy in Iron Man.
Yeah, it was good to see him play a nice guy role, because I feel bad for him, but. Yeah,
I mean, he was still mostly kind of angry looking, but yeah, that was him. I was trying to remember what he was from, but yeah, he was the dude from the Iron Man.
Yeah, and the other thing about this is that, you know, he does think about it and decide that he wants to pursue joining Starfleet very, very soon, because it's like a next morning thing, apparently. And
compressed timelines everywhere, except later where it's inconvenient to have a compressed timeline, which we'll get to. But yeah, he's lost in his life in the middle of farm country. And then big guy comes along with some cutting words and kind of like smacks some sense into him and goes like, why don't you give it a try? What else you got going on? Just going to keep drinking and fighting random dudes here and getting beat up?
Yeah, and one thing we glossed over, though, was the Vulcan Science Academy.
Oh, yeah, where they're all in their little half-circle pits learning calculus.
Yeah, which is supposed to be evocative of when Spock is retraining his mind in Star Trek IV, which you saw, where they're just answering rapid fire questions about things.
Mm.
That room, it's very production designy and makes no sense at all.
No, especially the way you would like climb up out of the thing with the little staircase thingy in the back from your little pod area. Like, it doesn't, I don't know why that was ever.
I mean, if they were really forward thinking, they would have just given everyone VR goggles because VR is the future of that sort of thing.
Mm.
Just a bunch of Vulcans standing in like a big cafeteria room wearing VR goggles.
Not as cinematic, I would say. Now,
it's VR. You can make it as cinematic as you want.
Yeah. Now I know from the before times that Spock had been picked on when he was a child by other kids because of his genetics and lineage, etc. Because they view humans as inferior and he's part human.
His disadvantage.
Yeah. They play that up big time here in an effort to get you to understand his feelings about this as quickly as possible. And they feature a fight with him where he goes and talks to his dad. And they also have him later on when we switch from Kid Spock to Zachary Quinto Spock. He talks to his mother, Winona Ryder, matronly, elderly Winona Ryder, who it's so strange.
I don't like her in this movie.
It's very weird the way they chose to play it because she feels like a young person playing an older person. And I know she's not, you know, technically it's fine that she is the mother age wise. It's just that the way that she emotes, it's sort of like you're acting like you're older than you are.
I think the thing that I can't look past is just the Winona Ryderness of her a little bit. Just her tempo is, yeah, it's that not so matronly way she speaks and emotes.
You know when people try to act like they're old or sickly, and then they just put old people makeup on them? Imagine if you didn't put any old makeup on her, and then you have Winona Ryder's performance.
Well, they put old makeup on her, but then they just turned the lights down where you couldn't tell.
Well, it was like barely old person makeup. It was like the corners of her mouth had some wrinkles. It was like, okay, gosh.
Her hair had some gray streaks and stuff, but yeah, just a little bit of furrows.
Well, that's why they won an Emmy for the makeup. But
it was entirely because of her character?
I'm assuming, because everything else is kind of, you know, standard Star Trek. Fair. They have this exchange where he relates his nervousness and how, you know, he wishes that he could be he wants to please her and is concerned that she would be upset if he purges all of his emotions through the Vulcan ritual of Kalinar, which is explained in a very as you know Bob kind of a way, but I don't know how else they would have got through it for the audience paying attention at home. Because that's an obscure reference to the motion picture, which people probably should not even go see now that I've said those words.
Is that the entire takeaway from the movie?
Oh, God. That movie is so dull. I will never make you watch that, Dan, ever.
Thank you.
Not even the director's cut. Nothing about it. You get a pass on that one. The thing with that is there is a reference to Kalinar, which is this ritual, and you purge the emotion, and he doesn't because he hears V'ger in space, and then he goes off. We don't need any of that. Instead, we have this scene where he's going to go through with Kalinar, but he gets accepted in spite of his disadvantage, and then he goes away to Starfleet rather than completing the ritual. And this is the guy who plays the chief Vulcan jerkwad is actually he's been in Star Trek before as other roles, so go have fun and look him up later. But he goes off to Starfleet to do Starfleet, and so does Kirk, and they finally meet after the Kobayashi Maru, a test that he's going to complete. And Bones is very upset that he's gonna take the test because, you know, why would you put yourself through that again? Nobody takes it twice. And he's like, I got it all figured out. And he maybe does, maybe doesn't. You never know. Suspense will kill you. Unless you've seen other films, and you know that he definitely already has it figured out. But
and then, of course, since that scene where he's telling him he's going to go take it again is a walk and talk, they walk past some girls, and Kirk turns and says, "Hello, ladies," and then continues with this conversation, which he does like three times in this movie.
Misogyny. But you can take Kirk out of the 60s, but you can't take the 60s out of Kirk. And so
he's very Zap Brannigan, right down to the red uniform, although he doesn't wear a skirt in this one.
Oh, yeah. And he does go meet an alien that is green, but it's different from Kif. So he apparently comes across an Orion who he fancies, which is also a reference to the original series where they had Orions, which was fascinating because green makeup was hard.
The green people? Oh, yeah. They're called Orions?
Yes. Well, in the original series, there's a lot of stuff where they just like took Greco-Roman names and just slapped it on things. Like the Klingon homeworld is Kronos, but then later on they're like, oh, you know what? We probably shouldn't just call it that. Let's make up a Klingon-sounding name. So then they called it Kronos, but spelled it differently. And so it's like Q-U apostrophe O-N-O-S or something. And so it's just like they get a little funky with this stuff and play it fast and loose whenever they want to. But in the original series, there's a lot of, you know, like Vulcan, Ryans, etc. But you know, there's the whole thing of like, oh, I'll get in trouble with my roommate for bringing back another guy. And then he's all like, oh, another guy? How dare you? And it's just like, you dog. You horrible dog.
And he's just like, how many guys do you bring back here? She's like, yeah, shh, hide under the bed.
Yeah, well, I mean, the kind of thing that wouldn't faze him if you were asked the same question.
The reason this scene exists, aside from Uhura's discovery of the Radiohead, like, I assume you've seen the cutout part where...
Discovery of the Radiohead?
The radio signal. Did I say Radiohead?
Yes. I don't
belong here. No, I said radio something.
You said Radiohead, but anyway.
No, the isn't she the one who sort of like helps him get with the in with the programming to hack the thing?
No.
It's cut out of the movie, but somebody does.
Okay. Well, anyway, he goes off the next day. Well, he gets flushed out by Uhura, who's very upset about him being there, and he's all like, "Oh, but you know, I'm totally fine being around you in your underwear."
Also, apparently it's 3 years later and he's still just trying to get her name, which is slightly odd. His fixation is a little peculiar at this point if we take their timeline as is.
Yeah, the word stalker springs to mind. But we go to the Kobayashi Maru test, and this is a far more elaborate version than what you saw at the beginning of Star Trek II, where you see the Klingon cruisers, but they have a more sophisticated device for rendering this as opposed to like some wireframes that are, you know, barely moving around things and like some spheres that are inside other spheres. I don't know how much of that you remember from Star Trek 2, but
a little bit. This one looks a little nicer, except I don't know who designed the outfits they're wearing in this particular scene, but they're very peculiar wool, like turtleneck jacket things.
It's very strange. But also, one of the weird things that always jumps out at me is when they say Klingon warbirds, because that's, I think, the first time I've ever heard in Star Trek a Klingon ship referred to as a warbird. Now, there are Klingon birds of prey and Romulan birds of prey, but that was the first time it was used interchangeably, which is a little tiny thing that always kind of sticks out at me because I'm the kind of person who would notice that sort of thing and totally watches over you. So we'll move past that. And
I didn't notice it at all.
We cut to the surprise on Shock's on Spock's face because he designed the test and somebody cheated, and Kirk does his little apple biting and pointing thing. The apple is of course a reference to Star Trek II as well because he bites a big apple when he bests Khan when they're in the Genesis cave.
I remember that as well.
Yes. You were also present when we talked about that, but they go through the thing where Admiral Tyler Perry is very upset. Well, not very upset. I would hardly say that he does any sort of emoting. But Admiral Tyler Perry convenes a big old hearing with like literally everyone in their suits.
This is where things get a little bit weird. I mean, he did well with what he had, but he had two scenes where he was like, "We're angry at you, Kirk. You cheated." And then his next scene is, "Thank goodness for you, Kirk. You saved everybody." It's like,
yeah,
didn't give you much to work with there. But yeah, this is where the timeline starts to get weird for me. So he cheated on the test. He immediately gets court-martialed. He's well, brought in front of this entire council unknowingly, apparently. They just call everybody, and then they drag him up to the front, which is a very peculiar way to conduct business. And then he starts arguing with Spock, and then they don't get to finish their conversation because there's a distress signal and everybody's got to go, which this is one of those things where it's like, okay, compressed timeline. And then sure, these guys have been there for 3 years, which we glossed over, but like they're all still cadets and now you're on active duty, which, oh, it feels weird to me.
Yes. I think they wanted to just skip ahead again. They wanted to have some of the academy, but not all of the academy. And then
you got Bones being all sassy, like, you know, "I'm senior medical officer." It's like, how are you a senior medical officer already?
Well, he wasn't a senior medical officer already. That was after the doctor on board got killed.
Well, no, he says those words, though. He's like, you're going to let me on the thing with Kirk, or you're going to have to explain why they went into a distress without a senior medical officer.
I thought they just said without a... Anyway, it doesn't matter.
Well, he's chief medical officer later, but he uses the word senior, which I found peculiar. Maybe because he was a doctor when he got in or something, and then 3 years later he's senior. But anyway, still, the compressed timeline, weird.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of a nonsensical, like, let's have some escapades to get them on the thing. And also, we have a cameo here from one of the actors from Stargate Atlantis who was in the running to play Scotty, but lost to Simon Pegg. He has one of those ridiculous train conductor hats, and denies Kirk access to the ship.
I also love how there's you know, crazy action in the background. There's guys carrying big cases around left and right, and then like right behind Bones and Kirk while they're like having their discussion, like when he says like, "All right, come with me, I'm gonna get you on there." There's a forklift right behind them with the thing elevated, and it's got like a big piece of equipment. And it's just sort of like driving in little circles, and it's like, why is it lifting that thing up in the air and then just kind of doing circles in the middle of the, I guess it's background action. Whatever. Background action.
what's the thing they're supposed to say when they're in the background? So it looks like they're talking?
Harumph?
Yes.
I don't think people still say harumph. I mean, you can say whatever you want as long as it doesn't look like anything particular.
Well, it was the forklift equivalent, but they...
the forklift equivalent of harumph.
Yes. And so they get on the thing, and they're on the shuttle, and you know, Kirk returns the line that he had heard from Bones, where it was, "Careful, I might throw up on you," because he's ill now from the thing he was injected with, which is apparently something you keep stocked inside of your shuttle bay, but whatever.
It was a vaccine, but he had a bad reaction to the vaccine, which I haven't seen a reaction this bad since medical school, which of course you haven't because
you're in medical school. But they get out of the hangar, which is suspiciously evocative of like an X-wing hangar from A New Hope or et cetera. So they get out of there, and all the different kinds of shuttles go on up to space dock, which in this movie is a giant bubble, and with other little bubbles. And there's the Enterprise, and you know, rather than doing our usual thing of other Star Trek movies where you just slowly drive around it for 10 years, we really quickly go inside.
It's got a decent reveal. It's very, you know, pristine looking and fancy and big.
Too bad it's butt ugly. I
don't think it's ugly.
It looks beautiful from the neck up, which is the saucer section that they copied directly from Star Trek the Motion Picture. And then the bottom half of it is just sort of an ugly, stretchy mess. And then it has these curved up nacelles, which are really close together and overinflated, sort of like boat pontoons. I don't really care for the design of that at all. But
they're cool looking. I don't like the butt section where the ships go into, but I like the whatever the thing you call it, the turbines.
The turbines.
The things that turn blue and make it go.
The nacelles, the warp nacelles, Dan. Don't you know anything?
Warp nacelle, sure. Of course I do.
This will be on the test later. So they get on board, and then they're in, I think it's the Budweiser factory in Van Nuys. And those are all the big tanks where they process beer. So I'm sure it smelled great on set. And they use this weird sort of industrial factory look for the lower decks, which is slightly unusual. And they try to spice it up with some modern stuff every now and then by placing some economical pieces. But it's very weird because it's like, why are there big beer tanks in the... Anyway, well, I mean, there are a lot of crew people. Maybe they need a lot of beer, but whatever. They get on board and they...
It's all the warp tanks where you keep your warp. gotta have extra warp. You know, at the end there, he says his warp stuff is at maximum, so the tanks are topped off.
That's exactly it. That is 100% how it works. I'm so glad you intuited that from just watching that scene. And we have him trying to dodge Spock, and they try to go get him cured from the thing that he got a cure for before.
It's like, you're having a bad reaction. We're just lay down. I'm going to give you a sedative, and you're going to sleep. And as he's dragging him through, he says hello to another nurse lady.
Yeah. And then they start talking about... Kirk overhears the announcement about things, and the fleet's about ready to leave. And
lightning storm in space. And then he wakes up out of his, sleep, whatever... sedative thing, and then replays it to make sure he heard the word lightning storm in space correctly.
Yeah, and then his tongue swells from the other thing. This is what I was getting at when I was saying it's just kind of slapsticky. And so they have him go up to the bridge and relay this, that it's that they're going into a trap, and Spock is very upset about Kirk's presence on board the ship, and Pike is all like, oh, really? Are you sure about that? And Uhura backs him up reluctantly, and then Spock says, well, I trust Uhura, so then that must be true.
I do like the little bit of humor that they put in with Sulu forgetting to take off the parking brake or whatever, because that's really what allows them to not die, because he took off late, so they're going to be the last ones there. So they've got a little bit extra time for this conversation to happen, and then for them to search the radio channels and find nobody's out there, and that's peculiar. And you know, just that goofy little moment that was a throwaway or whatever, where Sulu's the new guy and he doesn't know how to fly the plane or whatever, actually saves their lives.
I wish they had done something else rather than a goofy moment, like they just weren't ready to leave yet, or the last shuttle was still coming on board or something, because it just seems so sort of beneath Sulu to be that incompetent.
Well, he's brand new. It's his first time at the chair. And it's a new ship.
Yeah. So, well, anyway, agree to disagree on that one. But they fly off towards Vulcan, we get Chekhov, played by Anton Yelchin, who does a fantastic job, and unfortunately he has died recently, and it was right after he had completed Beyond, and he was gonna go do other stuff, so it's pretty sad. He was a young and interesting and talented actor, and he turns in a very good performance as Chekhov in both of these films. He's very excited and youthful and very interested in things, and they play off of the accent quite a bit, with the computer not understanding what he's saying, with Victor. Anyway, I don't know why they would necessarily have given him that code, but they...
Although I don't know why they had him, like, run all the way down to the transporter room to do that thing where he knew the math to do the thing that the other person didn't. Like, they don't have redundant controls up there where he doesn't have to like sprint through the whole ship?
Apparently not. Also, it's looks more dynamic, I guess, on film.
It certainly does.
Yeah. Rather than having people just type things in, as we saw in The Social Network. Six Social Network burn. You go, J.J. Abrams. Can you imagine J.J. Abrams' Social Network?
I can. I'd prefer not to.
What if David Fincher did a Star Trek movie? Anyway, that's a nightmare. Let's back away from this.
It would be like the Joyless one where it's an action movie and bad stuff happens.
Yeah, and yep. And so they get out of there towards Vulcan, and they have their conversation about things, and then Pike comes up with this plan about how they'll definitely, totally, maybe kind of be ready. They show up, and there are all these blown up ships, and they gotta dodge around them real fast, and they scrape one of the brand new nacelles, remember those? Those are the stick things. Mm-hmm. And they're just like, oh no, oh crud, things. And Nero is over there with a thingy that's drilling through a planet. And we don't necessarily know why he's doing any of this at this point in the film. But he is very upset to see the Enterprise and fires on it with things. Except he wants Captain Pike to come over now that he's done that, just like he did at the beginning of the film.
Yeah, he was just gonna like, yeah, blow him up, whatever, and then he sees that it says Enterprise. He's like, I know Enterprise, that's where Spock is, because I did my research on Spock in this 25 years that we've had to just sort of chill out here in space, so let's capture him, or let's mess with him and do stuff. And again, back to timeline stuff, they always talk about the giant ship and formidable weaponry and what have you. I guess technology moves fast. I mean, 129 years is not a short time, but that's I don't know if that's long enough to really make like massive leaps in space torpedo technology.
Well, also this is a mining ship. So like why does it have all of these torpedoes? It's not even like repurposed mining lasers or something. It's like definitely torpedoes, physical well, objects.
You don't make a spaceship without torpedoes. It's just like you don't make a car without wheels.
Yeah, it's exactly. The spaceships run on torpedoes.
It's a feature. Mm-hmm. It comes with those torpedoes from the factory.
Yeah, but you got to pay extra if you want to get the quantum torpedoes.
Yeah, the ones with the undercoating.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Resist the salt in the road really well.
Yeah, it's gonna keep your investment protected.
Nobody wants rusty torpedoes.
No. And then we've got some rain guards for if you want to top that off on top of your spaceship. But so they have this exchange where they're like, yes, we'll totally send Pike over. And so Kirk is like, you can't do that. This is a trap. And Spock's like, yes, you also can't do this. This is also a trap. And Pike's like, yes, I know this is totally a trap, but it's going to give you guys time to do all this other stuff. So do your stuff. And we gotta prevent him from doing this thing with the platform. So come with me, Kirk. You're gonna land on the platform. I'm making you first officer right now. And I have a question about who was previously first officer, but I'm assuming he was killed in the initial volley or something, like the Doctor. But they have him and some other red shirt guy and Sulu go down to do this because they have hand to hand training that would be useful on a platform suspended above the planet surface and can dive through the atmosphere. Now, that doesn't necessarily pan out in all three cases because one of them is sort of some sort of overzealous, warmongering, overexcitable fellow.
Engineer Olson, which they do actually mention his name over the radio once before you see him where he does his stupid thing. So they at least tried to put him in the movie for more than 5 seconds before they killed him.
Yeah, he dies. And they have Sulu, and they have a comedic exchange of, well, what kind of, you know, fighting are you proficient in? And he says, fencing. Which is a callback to an old Star Trek episode called Naked Now, where they all got drunk on some sort of space alcohol that transmitted through air. Anyway, it's a weird episode, but they made a sequel of it for the Next Generation cast too. But they have Kirk and Sulu square off in that one with a little bit of fencing, and that was a nod to that. Although the sort of robot sword he takes out when he gets down to the platform is not much of a fencing implement.
No, it's more of a katana. It's pretty cool though.
Yeah. It seems a little weird in terms of self-assembling robot swords being common, but whatever.
Very efficient space-wise.
Yes. Well, you always want to be efficient when you're in space. And so they...
Because one thing that they don't have in space is a lot of room to store stuff.
No. Room is costly. Well, the problem is really the climate-controlled storage. That comes at a premium.
Are you saying they have non-climate controlled storage? Like just like stuff that they put in like a big net and like tape to the outside of the spaceship?
Well, yes, but there's a lot of internal pressure on those markets.
That's a space joke.
Yeah. Anyway, They have the thing with him on them on the platform, and they're trying to disable it, and there are bad guys who are inside of the platform, and they come out, and there's fighting and stuff. And you know, we had an exhilarating scene of them landing with their helmets and things, and hopefully we'll never see people jumping through space from one thing to another thing ever again in Star Trek, but we do. And so
super fun in the next one.
Yeah, it's so bad.
I've got a heads-up targeting system, and oh no, it's broken. Yeah.
It's cracked. And so they beat up the Romulans somehow, stab one of them, kick one of them over a fire vent, which seems perilous. I don't even know why that's there. They go through all of the stuff so that they can fire their phasers to try and disable the drill, and they do disable the drill, which is part of the mission. Meanwhile, Pike is taken hostage, and that was, you know, everyone saw that one coming. And then they are going to release the red matter. What is the red matter, you ask? No one knows. It is a ball of CG. And so they stick their giant comical syringe in.
What kind of shader would you say is on the red ball? Isn't the red ball the example shape they use for shader like selection in the little picker there?
Yeah, but I think that this is some sort of like car paint kind of shader where there's some of the bioelectric stuff going on. Anyway, it's shiny, but it's like double shiny. Don't worry about it. And so they use the comical oversized syringe to remove something which can destroy everything. Which seems
just a dot of it, and leave the rest of the 4 gallons of it floating.
Yeah, well, the recipe only called for a pinch, and so they take their pinch of red matter over to their torpedo. They load that up because they've had 25 years to work on some sort of mechanism to do this, and they fire that down to the planet's surface into the big old hole that they had dug. Now, I don't know why it necessarily needed to be in the planet's surface. It seems awfully destructive. It seems like you really don't even need to drill. you could have just dropped that on one side of the planet and it would have been, you know, toast. Maybe he really wanted to absorb every single little atom, but it does seem like an awful waste of time.
It could bounce off and like kind of pull them in if they do it on the surface. If they drop it right in the center, it'll sort of implode on itself.
I suppose, but I'm not really sure about the bounciness of quantum singularities, aka black holes. But maybe that was a concern.
Well, maybe you just need a spoonful of red matter to make a planet implode, which is what they were going to do with the supernova thing that we learn later. But you got to put it in the right place, otherwise it'll only pull in just a little bit. It's got to be in the center, though.
Yeah. Well, I'm not well read on this topic. So
on the topic of fictional red matter.
No. I'm sure there's a wonderful Wikipedia page on fictional red matter. So they fire the MacGuffin inside. And for some reason all of the Vulcans were totally chill with somebody drilling into the planet for this whole entire time and weren't even remotely concerned.
Well, it didn't take that long, you know, maybe like half hour.
Seems like it took longer than that because the ships had to get there from elsewhere.
Well, this is the thing. Again, timelines.
Yeah.
Like they mention when they're warping from Earth to Vulcan that they'll be there in like 4 minutes total.
It doesn't make any sense, really.
No. And then like when they're on their way back, they're like going to go meet up with the Federation, which takes like hours. And then Nero's on his way to Earth, which takes like hours and long enough for Kirk to go down to the planet, meet Spock, do the thing, do the warp back to the thing, and then fight with the Spock, and then change directions, and then go find Nero behind Jupiter. Like all of that is also in 4 minutes, or what happened? Like you got to take a different route on your way home or something? Trade winds.
Yes. Well, you see, the problem is they're going against the jet stream.
Right,
so
exactly. That's the problem with when you warp. It makes all of the wind go in that direction in the same warp speed that you were at before. So you got to go double the warp back, or it just slows you down.
Yeah, it's like riding a boat over the wake of another boat.
Exactly. Your space wake.
Yes. totally how that works. But yeah, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I mean, there are inconsistencies in terms of like how long it takes to go anywhere in Star Trek. So, you know, you can't be too hard on them. But internally inside of the same film, it's probably best if they had tried to reconcile this.
Yeah.
But
as somebody who like is not trying to rationalize this from Star Trek perspective, just for somebody like watching this going like, took you 4 minutes to get there. And now just because it's convenient for all of the action you have to do, in the other direction, it's going to take like way longer, like 30 minutes of screen time or whatever. Like, I don't enjoy that part. That bugs me a little bit.
No, they're just padding. So they have the thing where they get, once the drill's disabled, they beam up, Kirk and, Sulu off of the platform. And it's very dramatic because they leap off and there's the grabbing and oh no, can we beam them with the thing while they're moving? Two moving targets, oh no, and Chekhov fixes it and then they beam on to the pad and slam into it.
Yeah, and this is where I have a question about beaming and momentum. Because if they were moving that fast and then they like kind of crunched into the platform when they landed, why were they not moving the same speed? Like, does he have the ability to like slow their descent with the thing? Because if he just like beams them into the ship and they're still moving at like terminal velocity, they would just like splat on the transporter pad.
Well, worse than that, you saw what happened to Spock's mother when she was moved by the ground falling out from underneath her. And then she was supposed to be falling while she was in transport and broke up. So imagine someone is also falling and is being beamed into a place, then wouldn't they also keep falling while they were being beamed? It doesn't...
Well, Chekhov had enough time to compensate mathematically for them. He just didn't have enough time with Spock's mom because she had a shorter fall or a mountain fell on her or something. It was hard to tell.
Well, the ground fell from underneath her and then...
Right, yeah, but like how far did she fall? Because he was just like, I'm losing her. Ah, I can't do the math fast enough. And maybe it was because they were already beaming other people or something. I don't know. His interface is just like circles and lines and he's tapping things and typing stuff.
Yeah, well, I mean, basically the narrative said these people should live and these people should die. So let's not dwell too much on this. Because there's nothing much to say about that other than the narrative dictated life and death. And they have them on board and Kirk thinks that they should immediately go back towards Earth. And Spock says, no, we should go rendezvous with the fleet, like Captain Pike said. And he says, well, Captain Pike also says you should go get him. And he's like, well, tough. We're going to go rendezvous with the fleet. And there is an exchange here where they go back and forth about this, rather heated exchange. And then Kirk gets himself kicked off of the ship and marooned, which is not a tactic that we see employed in Star Trek previously, but he is...
Don't they have like a ship jail or something?
Yeah, it's called a brig.
Yeah, there you go. Throw him in the brig.
Yeah. We see the brig in the second movie.
It's a terrible bar, by the way.
The one on Abbot Kenny?
Yeah, it's a terrible bar.
Oh, I've never been in. It just smells like urine. Yeah. So they...
Precisely.
I've walked past the brig. But they get into the whole situation where he gets himself kicked off of the thing in the escape pod, and he wakes up on the ice planet, Vega 5 or whatever, which is funny. Because we immediately find out that this is somehow on the way back to Earth and near Vulcan, but not in the Vulcan system.
Well, it's just a big enough planet to have an outpost on it.
Yes. It's also very strange later on because after Kirk runs away from the ferocious, mangy alien polar bear teeth monster,
the yeti that gets eaten by the red thing,
yeah, and then there's the red thing who eats that, you know, because you got to have your Phantom Menace, there's always a bigger fish moment. And then the red thing chases Kirk and he falls off the thing, and then the red thing falls down, goes boom, and Kirk gets into a cave, the red thing comes after him, and then some guy with weird shoulder pads shows up waving a big fiery stick. And that scares away the giant monster that's nothing but teeth and claws.
Well, he lives in the snow, so he doesn't know what fire is, and it's warm and it's foreign, so it scares him.
Yeah, it's a little extreme though. But he gets out of there, and then Spock reveals himself, and this is of course Leonard Nimoy, who also passed last year, and he turns in a very good performance as Spock, as he always does, and they discuss quickly the series of events, including Leonard Nimoy doing an exposition dump via mind meld. And it gives you sort of a dreamlike sequence of him recounting the events that had transpired. There is a very loosey-goosey explanation of how they were going to create a black hole to suck up the Romulan star to prevent it from going supernova, which would save the planet, which doesn't make a ton of sense because it's like still a planet without a sun if you sucked up the whole thing and now it's orbiting a black hole. Or if you didn't suck up the whole thing, then it's not even really technically a star anymore. It's not really like a coherent plan.
There's a big explodey thing going towards Romulan, and we got to suck it into a black hole.
Romulus.
Sure.
Yes, not that Romulan. Too. No, but the Romulans are the people. Romulus is the planet, Dan.
Yeah, I know that. Again, yeah.
I've
been away for too long to use letters.
Apparently, Nero was on his simple mining vessel when he was very upset about the events that had transpired and thought that Spock had not done enough to save his planet, and so he goes after Spock, and this causes Spock to fire some of the red matter to disable the supernova thing, and then they get sucked into the time vortex, but at different times, and so one of them comes out one time, one of them comes out the other time, so what? They have the thing where... he also recounts when he came out that Nero had been waiting for him and he gets abducted somehow. I don't really know how that worked because as we see, Spock's ship has weapons and things and can fire at stuff. So I guess he just couldn't do it when he came out of the vortex-y thing or something.
Yeah, there was some Nero exposition there. There's a lot of Nero exposition there that I could do without the, you know, 25 years later, we've arrived at the coordinates we've calculated. It took you guys 25 years to do the math, whatever. And then it's like, what are we going to do now? The same thing we do every night, Pinky. Try to take over the world by capturing Spock as he comes out of a black hole that's going to appear from nowhere. You either know where he's going to come out, and then you just got to wait there, or you don't know, and then just keep searching and stuff or something. But like this idea that they like just showed up just in the nick of time for him to pop out of the thing was weird, and then... Well, I'm on the topic of Nero's exposition, like later when he's fighting Kirk and he goes like, I know your face from Earth's history. It's like, why? Do miners study Earth history of famous Starfleet captains? Because that's weird. But getting back to at the point where we learn Nero's basic motivation is that he was off planet doing whatever it is he does in his mining ship. And then the planet blew up and his wife and kid died. He's super angry and sad about it. And he blames Spock because Spock promised to fix it and didn't. So he's not particularly mad at like anything that anyone did. He's mad that like it couldn't be stopped in time. Cause Spock was like, oh yeah, we got a plan. We're going to rush our way out there. But then it's like, well, it was too late. So sorry, we didn't get here fast enough. And for that, Nero was going to kill everyone on all Starfleet planets. Because doesn't he say something to the tune of like, if I destroy all of Starfleet, like in the future, you guys won't be around to like screw up the plan to save us, which is like not how that works.
No. He is not of sound mind and body, and his crew really should not be following him. But maybe they're all also similarly impaired by vengeance.
They all seem a lot like soldiers for miners. But one other question I have for you, maybe you can enlighten me.
They don't look that young.
Well, yeah. But like they're all heavily armed and stuff with like rifles and things.
Well, you shouldn't give weapons to miners.
Jeez. Anyway, so how long do people live in Star Trek? Because Spock's at least 140.
I think Vulcans live to about 300-ish.
Oh, is it just Vulcans, or is that like people in general? Because like life expectancy is way longer.
Well, life expectancy in the Federation is longer, but the Romulans, I think, also are close to Vulcan physiology for aging. I don't know if you could tell, but they had pointy ears too, they I think would probably be in the same ballpark. Now, back to the dreamlike recounting of events. He explains that you know, all of this has happened, and they pull away, and it's like, oh, I felt a emotion. And he's like, yeah, the emotion, you know, sorry about that from the thing. That's too bad. And Nero had dropped me off on this planet to watch Vulcan be destroyed, which is a bad plan on several fronts, because why would you leave the person that you're interested in antagonizing on a planet where you, first of all, cannot ensure that he will see your reaction, second of all, can't see him seeing the reaction, and third of all, can't make sure that he just dies afterwards. It doesn't make any sense. It's just like,
he would have had a pretty good front row seat if he was on Nero's ship to watch the planet blow up.
Yeah, I mean, why didn't they just... Cause it, and it's not like, oh, well, they didn't have any prison facilities. Like, well, Christopher Pike was the whole entire time. But
well, maybe they only had one table to tie people to.
Oh, yeah. You know, you got to be careful. If you got multiple guests coming over, you need to have enough room to serve everyone.
It is but a lowly mining ship.
Yes, so lowly. But the weird thing, too, is this is also a JJ-ism of being able to see a planet being destroyed from another planet that's not even in the same system, which doesn't make a lick of sense if you think about it for any stretch of time, because Vega 5 or whatever is not in the Vulcan solar system. Like, it's not Vulcan 5. Like, it's somewhere else. So why does he see another planet get destroyed from another solar system, except for the fact that JJ just wanted him to see another planet get destroyed in the sky? And if it was as close as it was, as we see it depicted there, where it's basically larger than Earth's moon in the frame, then it would have destroyed the little planet that Spock was on, because it would have been like a moon or something. Like, it is so close to Vulcan that it is comical. But... you know, something that JJ repeats, unfortunately, in The Force Awakens, which I also objected to, was just like, it's preposterous that you can see something be destroyed from incredibly far distances. But they move past that, where Spock is all of a sudden like, yes, come quickly. There's a Starfleet outpost not that far from here. And it's like, how did Spock know that? That's something that the computer had told Kirk, unless Kirk told him, but he didn't tell him, but maybe he got it from the mind meld, or why didn't Kirk just say that?
Maybe Spock just like knows lots of that stuff, because he's had 100-something years to memorize all of the outposts.
Yeah, but if he knew it was there, then why was he hiding in this cave? Why wasn't he going towards that Starfleet outpost?
Well, he just got there, and he's an old fellow, so, you know, he was taking a rest, whatever.
Yeah, well, whatever. They go to the outpost, and they open the door, and inside is the guy who takes them to Scotty, and they go over stuff where Scotty is complaining about his rations. He's very upset about all of the stuff. Things do not seem to be run like a very tight ship here, as I might have expected, but they quickly discuss the matters of being able to do transport people at warp from vast distances, and they come up with a calculation to be able to do the thing on the shuttle thing, and Spock comes up with this flimsy excuse of, I can't go with you because I can't meet my former self, but your relationship with Spock is important, and you must make him feel emotionally compromised. This is incredibly important. Torture me, Jim. Torture me. And they have that exchange, and him and Scotty beam on to the engineering deck somewhere mysterious in Van Nuys. And Kirk is fine, and he's all, like, so excited about how that worked out. And then Scotty is inside of a water tube, being sucked through a flume thing. Around things that have transparent windows, just in case you need to check your water flow or people. He winds up inside of a water turbine, on the way to a water turbine. And then he pops the emergency hatch and he falls down. And it's just like, this is absurdly cartoonish. Like, you know, in Galaxy Quest when they had the chompers?
Yeah.
It's just like, why is this even here? Who would write this?
The chompers with water. It's their water reclaiming station, and they gotta you know, blend up the water so it's all one level of not poison anymore.
Yeah, you don't want your water to be too thick, and
you don't want chunky water.
No, God no. Especially, you know, sometimes you get that grit if you don't grind it fine.
Nobody wants grit in their water.
No, you don't want true grit anyway. But they. pop them out of the thing. Oh, side note, by the way. I went to the Paramount Cruise screening of this because a friend of mine worked for DD who did the Scotty in the Tube thing. So I got in on a guest pass to see it. So that was nice.
Are you telling me they didn't actually put Scotty in the tube?
No, surprise, surprise. But Simon Pegg is fine. He lives to fight another day. Now they get on up to the bridge where they're going to emotionally compromise Spock. Simon Pegg doesn't really understand this plan because he was just introduced to the movie. And he's just happy to be on a cool ship.
Cupcake captures him.
Yes. And Spock is trying to hold it all together. And then Kirk is unnecessarily mean to him about how he, you know, isn't really like respecting his mother, etc. And you don't talk about somebody's mama.
She died and you didn't even cry. You never loved her because you're a Vulcan and stuff and you don't do love.
Yeah, that was... It was awkward. And then they Kirk gets his face beat up and strangled a little bit, slightly throttled. And Spock realizes that he's been emotionally compromised and he recuses himself from his position.
Only because his dad yells at him to stop because he was like full-blown bloodlust going to murder him.
Yeah, a little bit. Fortunately, that didn't happen. That would have been an odd wrinkle in old Spock's plan. And so they...
You just see he's got like the Back to the Future like Polaroid of his timeline and he looks at it and suddenly he's just in jail.
It doesn't make any sense why anyone does anything in this film if they hope that it impacts the future or something. We'll get to that later, I'm sure, with Nero's plan to use red matter.
Especially because Spock's got his dump of like, well, Kirk's like, well, Nero's from the future. He knows what's going to happen. Spock's all like, well, he came back, so he changed everything and ruined it, so he knows nothing.
Yeah, but also it doesn't make any sense because it would be like a time paradox if you killed old Spock or you killed young Spock. Because then you wouldn't have the red matter to go back in time. Anyway, time travel is exceptionally complicated in any movie. And it is frequently really, really, really poorly executed in Star Trek. And this movie is no exception. And so they...
It could be worse. They basically go like, well, he came from another timeline. And now everything's different. So we can do whatever we want because time doesn't matter.
Yeah, except... He's going to get his wife and stuff back by making a strong Romulan Empire by blowing everyone else up so that the Romulan Empire can be strong.
I think we can safely assume that Nero has no idea what he's talking about.
Yeah, Nero should have stuck to mining. So they have the thing now where they've done this, and Bones is like, well, congratulations, Kirk. You got our captain... taken care of, and now we don't even have a first officer. And then there's the whole exchange of like, well, he made me first officer. And Sulu's like, yes, that totally happened. I heard that in the hallway. Right before Captain Pike died.
True story. I was there.
Yeah, right before he went over to the shuttle. And so we're all best buds now, and I'm in charge, which is a stretch, really, when you think about the events that have unfolded in the matter of hours that have transpired since the destruction of Vulcan. But they...
Chain of command, man. It's the only way that anyone knows what's going on when stuff goes crazy.
Yeah, so they come up with their plan to go back to Earth, and then they start talking about orbits of things, and they'll appear around Titan, one of Saturn's moons, and hide inside the dusty atmosphere so that they're not observed. Technically, sensors in Star Trek can detect ships at warp coming from other places, but whatever, no one cares. It's not a...
There's electromagnetic something or other from Saturn that'll hide them.
Yes, all of that, totally, when they're not even there yet. But they have the thing where they pop out to the place, and then it's like, well, now we just need to make sure that the drilling platform doesn't work so that we can do this stuff. Oh, no, we need to beam onto the ship. But who's going to beam with me? And then it's like, well, I'm going to do it. Because I'm Spock, and I'm back now. I'm totally not emotionally compromised anymore, and we totally fought, but we're cool now. And there's a part of me, you know, everyone's cheering in the audience, because you're like, yay, the friends are together. The friends who've always been friends are together. And it's like, they haven't always been friends in this movie, guys. And it doesn't make a tremendous amount of sense in terms of, like, how things have transpired here. But
well, he took a powwow and recalibrated himself, and then he, like, snuck back onto the bridge and he's listening to the plans and everything. He's like, all right, maybe this guy's not a total doofus. He's kind of got a plan that'll sort of work from this perspective, and I can offer some help, so I might as well do that and, you know, get back in the game. And then he, you know, chuck on the shoulder. See, we are getting to know each other.
But it also doesn't make a tremendous amount of sense why they only could beam two people. They didn't really super explain that one either. Because, like, take some security guys or something.
Well, they had a small crew. I mean, people died in the big thing earlier, so it's limited crew. You got to keep the people on the ship to do the things and the jobs.
Yeah, just take some warm bodies. It doesn't matter. Just take more people. So they don't do that, though. And they
want to be discreet. They want to get Pike and get the ship and the red matter and fly away.
Yes, which is totally going to work flawlessly.
If there was any, you know, logic to the design of that ship, they would have been in the cargo bay.
that's a funny moment, because they're not. And they're surrounded by Romulans who start slowly firing at them once they realize that they're humans and a Vulcan. They're a human and a Vulcan there. And they're firing like crazy. And totally missing two people who are standing in the open. And they get away Die Hard style, off to other areas, and they take down some other guys and they beat up some other people, and somebody runs and tells Nero, and then he slow motion runs over and like flips his big dramatic trench coat thing over stuff.
He definitely is not on wires when he jumps.
Oh God, it's so ridiculous. There is nothing positive to say about Nero. They're fighting about things and stuff.
He's strong. I mean, I think he works out and stuff.
You know, they're all strong. Even guy who I don't even know the name of, who is his second in command, is strong. And so Spock goes to the little jellyfish ship and he gets on board, and it's like, welcome back, Ambassador Spock. Voice print recognized. And it's like, I don't think that's how that works. But they
well, that's there, so Kirk can go, wow, that's weird, and Spock can go, there's something you're not telling me. Mm-hmm. Which I guess in the moment I don't need the logic of that to actually make sense for Spock to go like, oh, maybe this guy has a plan and he's not just like totally off the cuff all the time. But it doesn't make any sense.
No. And they Kirk's gonna go get Pike, and he wants Spock to go blow up the thing, the drill and stuff, and so,
but there's only a 4% chance.
You know, you just got to go with it.
You should have said, never tell me the odds.
No, that's different. It's a different thing. And so Spock blasts out of the thing and starts firing at the chain thing and the stuff, and then breaks the drill thing. And Nero's very upset about this.
Yeah, he got distracted trying to choke Kirk to death. And then Spock knocked out the thing. Now they can beam and stuff. So he goes and gets Pike, and then starts charging at the ship and shooting at him and stuff and antagonizing him, and then he warps away, and then Nero warps after him, and they're like, they're on a collision course, and they're shooting at each other, and he fires everything, which is not really
absurd.
Great for, you know, your reserves or whatever, because...
Absurd. Just, it's absolutely absurd. It doesn't make any sense. And they're like these little turrets springing up out of everywhere firing rockets, and it's just like, this doesn't make any sense. Like, how would he have all these torpedoes? Just like it's almost like Saris's ship in Galaxy Quest, where it's just like just brimming with weapons.
Yeah, I'm towing mines, basically.
Yeah. But he's not towing mines. He's towing the Enterprise, shows up, and then just like fires at all of the torpedoes and destroys them. Spock can fly the ship into the other ship and get beamed out of there. And then the red matter is triggered, which seems ill-advised, since you don't really know exactly the size of the thing that would happen from this. But maybe he had done a rough calculation before he had plotted this course.
Yeah, I mean, the only way to buy any of this is to buy that Nero is so off the deep end, angry and just kind of nuts, that he doesn't care if all of his crew dies and everyone dies, just as long as he gets to kill Spock. Which, yeah, you don't buy, because as you pointed out earlier, his plan for older Spock was to just put him on a planet by himself and let him watch his planet die. Because if he really wanted to kill Spock, he could have just done that. But I guess now he's angry at Spock because Spock stole the ship and the red matter. He wasn't angry enough to kill Spock before, but when he stole the ship and the red matter back, now he wants to kill him.
But it also doesn't make any sense, because he could have, when he was requesting the shuttle come over with Captain Pike, he could have had Spock come over then and have Spock, young Spock, as a prisoner. And he also doesn't do that.
Well, that would have given away his plan, which was to not, there's no plan.
No, there's no plan. He's a terrible bad guy.
He's just got a buy the book thing. Like, his thing is, you know, capture the captain and take their information and then blow up the ship.
I don't really think that's a book.
That's Nero's book.
Yeah. It's like a pamphlet.
A definitive guide to not having a plan.
Ugh, man. It's just the definitive guide to winging it. And so the red matter gets triggered and it causes a little black hole to form in the sort of back quarters of the ship, but slice through it somehow. That's not really, it doesn't seem very three-dimensional, but whatever. And
also, it takes a really long time for this black hole to get up to speed and start doing bad stuff.
Yeah, well, they used a lot more of the red matter this time. So
you're saying it had to ramp up?
Yeah, well, I mean, the red matter was consuming the other red matter, so, you know, it's fighting itself.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Two negatives make a positive?
Positively positive about that. So they have the Enterprise where he's, you know, Kirk's like, yeah, we'll rescue you, etc., blah, 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 blah.
Let's be the really sarcastic bigger man in this conversation and call and be like, hey, we'll totally rescue you, even though we're the reason you're about to all die. And then Spock's like, I don't want to do that because he's a jerk. And he's like, yeah, don't worry. He's not going to say yes. And of course, he doesn't say yes. He said, I'd rather die. He's like, cool, we can help you out with that, too. And they blast him with everything they got.
Yeah, it does seem oddly out of character for him to want someone to die like that.
Well, he says it in a very Vulcan way. Like, you know, in this instance, I'd be okay if you didn't offer them that.
Yeah, but, you know, it still seems awfully petty from the perspective of the situation.
I don't know that it seems petty because he blew up a planet with 6 billion Vulcans
on it. No, but I mean, Spock's all about, you know, like logic and justice and stuff and like taking, you know.
Well, this is young Spock. He's extra emotional.
Flavor blasted Vulcan. And so he's.
Spock goes to Flavor Town.
Oh, God.
he should bleach his tips.
Well, that's where the new Vulcan colony is Flavor Town. So they.
Jalapeno poppers for everybody.
Oh, God. Well, you won't be living long and prospering after those. So they have a big dramatic thing of it exploding, and oddly enough, they fire everything at the ship, which is half in a black hole. I don't know what that's supposed to safeguard exactly to ensure that it absolutely blows up, but it does. And then black hole
sets off the rest of the red matter.
Yeah, and then the black hole is going, and they're all like, oh no, we can't get away, I'm at maximum warp, we're not going anywhere, what do we do, oh no, eject the core, and they eject the core, and kaboom, and you get a very beautiful shot of all this blue stuff, the Enterprise just coasts away.
I have a question.
Yes.
How did they stay at warp if they ejected the core?
They didn't. I don't know exactly what happened there.
Is it like warp momentum?
I don't know, but it doesn't make any sense because the way that warp theoretically works in this fictional universe is that the warp core makes a warp field, which distorts space and allows the ship to go fast. So if you don't have the cores anymore, how can you distort space to make the ship go fast? Unless it's the explosion doing it, but then you'd be moving at the same speed as the explosion. But
what if you open the thing and then you get to stay in it as long as you want until you close it? Do you have to manually close your warp tube?
Damn, it's not a tube. It's like a torus. It's like a donut. It's like a space donut. Mm. So anyway, they get flung from the explosion at speed of some kind.
It pushes them one direction. Yeah. It pushes the black hole the other way, which I think is how black holes work.
Definitely. It is 100% how all of this works, and it is super accurate for physics. And
I mean, at a very minimum, it's a clever plan you didn't think of. It's cinematic. It looks really cool. I don't like how quickly they went from, like, look at us, we're on top of our game, and we're defeating Nero, and all right, let's go home, to, oh my God, we are about to die. We have zero options. Let's do the craziest thing we can think of. That's like 40 seconds on screen where he goes from like, do it, do it, do it, from like when they blew up Nero. It's like, okay.
Yeah, well, they've ejected warp cores before in other Star Trek films and they've in shows, and they've also done ridiculous last minute escapes. I don't know if you remember Star Trek 2, where they had a last minute escape, but that was about fixing a warp drive, so it was a little different. But things exploded and they got away. And we have our little ceremony here at the end with Admiral Tyler Perry, who is bestowing ranks on people for things. And because of all of the crazy coincidental shenanigans that occurred for Kirk, he gets his captainship of the Enterprise. And Spock... Well,
extreme bravery or whatever, which is basically... I mean, it's basically stupidity, but he's... Yeah. He's, I mean...
He's just lucky.
At the end, he didn't learn his lesson. He's never, ever really afraid of anything, which I guess is the character trait that makes Kirk Kirk. Like, he's not... He doesn't believe in no-win situations or whatever. Like, he's not afraid of basically any situation.
Yes.
Which allows him to do some unique things, I guess. But, you know, the celebrating him as, you know, outstanding bravery in the face of danger or whatever is just kind of like, well, you're a reckless, crazy person. Have a ship.
Yep. He's kind of just a sociopath.
But he's endearing, too, right? We like him because he's Kirk.
He's a very charismatic sociopath. So they give him his ship, and Spock is the first officer. And
well, he requests to be the first officer.
Yes, because they have a nice little back and forth about
how
the...
provide character references if you like.
Yes, and they get on board. And we get the crew that we've been familiar with throughout that had been assembled through the course of the production. and
Star Trek Assemble!
Dan. No, Thor, Thor died at the beginning of the movie. But they...
Time travel!
No, that had already happened.
He got sucked into the black hole.
And so they... Okay. So then they do the shot of the ship spinning around, and they do the space, the Final Frontier thing, and it's Nimoy doing it, which he has done on occasions in the past. And it's extra gravelly. And it's a little way of sending off this brave new crew on their voyage, and they warp away. And there's big dramatic music, and we hear the original Star Trek theme for the first time orchestrated in the film, really. And there are these horrible CG planets that show up for the title credits. I don't understand who they farmed that out to, but unpleasant to look at.
I could tell you.
Oh. Who?
Later.
Okay. Oh, it's one of those secrets.
It's one of those companies that might make a plug-in that you're familiar with but not super into.
Okay, we will discuss this later.
So they launch off into space on their mission to boldly go and explore and stuff. And we got the crew that we know. We got these new characters in a new timeline that is different, and we like these people, and they can go do their stuff, and it's fun and exciting, and they can go tell all kinds of fun new stories that never tread back on former material ever again.
No, they'll never make any references. Ever
I really
again.
Wish they didn't, like, because this was a great reset. I think this was a really good reset for modern audiences. It was fun. It was action. Yeah, sure, there was a little bit of, like, you know, again, they overstepped the reset a little bit, and they could dial it back in the movie after this. But this was a good reset and a good movie. And then after that, they should just go in this new direction and do new stuff.
Yes, and they didn't. And we will talk about that in the next episode, because I have a feeling that we both have a lot to say, especially now that you've seen Star Trek 2 and can sort of comprehend some of the reused material a little bit more, as well as some callbacks that are also made in this film. It's just like, you guys can go forwards and do brave new things that
yeah,
we don't
they,
necessarily...
They got all their callbacks out of the way. They got all their references and they're a little bit of fan service. And then they're like, okay, we're full bore in this new direction. Like, we're hinting at where we came from, and we're just moving this way now, and isn't it awesome? And it was pretty awesome. And then after that, like, be done. Be done with the canon. Make new stuff.
Yeah.
They didn't.
No.
And that's a bummer.
Yep. And the jury is out on the third movie in this progression here, and I don't even know if they're going to make any more after. We'll find out, I suppose. It seems unlikely at the pace they're going. Every 4 years seems awfully slow.
Well, everybody's fascinated with their Star Warses.
Yeah.
But it's not like they're going to like let the Star Trek franchise go away.
Oh, no, but that's why they have the new series coming to CBS.
So you think they're going to go back to just series instead of movies?
It is a possibility, at least for some time. I don't know how much there is left in this particular vein of the Kelvin timeline, Chris Pine, etc. group.
But I like Chris Pine as Kirk. I would enjoy seeing him do things.
Oh, no, I'm not complaining about Chris Pine, and I'm not complaining about Zachary Quinto, and I'm not complaining about Zoe Saldana, and I'm not complaining about Carl Urban or Simon Pegg or John Cho or Anton Yelchin. They all did good jobs reprising these characters that we're familiar with. Ben Cross's Sarek was not very good, and Winona Ryder as Amanda Grayson was not very good. And the whole thing with Nero being Eric Bana, also not great, but not a problem, because we'll never see him again. he's gone off to the same place all Eric Bana characters go.
Slowly walking down the PCH with sad music.
So I'm not like poo-pooing it. I'm just not sure how long they're gonna go if they're going every 4 years with this film franchise. It doesn't seem like you're moving at a brisk pace, but you never know. Maybe they'll up the ante or something, depending on how the movie does. There is a lot of Star Trek which hinges on the performance of properties before they make any decisions about the next thing down the pipe. So we'll talk some more about the future of this in the upcoming episodes, and we'll have our nice little Star Trek fest, the JJ Star Trek fest,
Star Trek-a-thon.
Yep, boldly recapping where everyone has recapped before.
Finally, Star Trek for the millennials that I can finally watch.
Millennials don't watch anything anymore, Dan.
Well, we watch it as long as it's not on cable.
Well, it needs to be little tiny Snapchat pieces of people pretending to be characters. And it's about the real reality of what it would be like if you were Kirk.
To promote the next movie, they should have Kirk in character doing like Snapchat stories, and then Spock doing like one or two and being like really super awkward because he's not into it.
I'd rather not. There's...
That reminds me. Have you seen these Quicken Loans commercials with Vulcan in them?
Yeah, you sent me the link. It was awful. My
God, there's so many of them, and they're so terrible.
They're all very bad. But we'll save that for another time when we talk about Beyond, maybe. We'll talk about the marketing tie-ins. But this concludes this particular jaunt in the franchise.
Star Trek.
Nothing but Star Trek. Those near and far treks. They must go on.
Indeed.